Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sangoma, Stories from the Front Lines of Mediation. I am your host, Batabile Mtombeni, mediator and negotiation coach. Today, the Greater New York Chapter of the Association for Conflict Resolution awarded my guest, Layla Love, the ADR Achievement Award for 2012. Layla, a tremendously accomplished pioneer mediation educator, is currently a professor of law and the director of the Kukin Program for Conflict Resolution at Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law here in New York City. She is the co-editor of a brand new book, Stories Mediators Tell. I just love that we are doing such similar things, telling mediator stories. You're listening to South, a piece by one of my favorite composers and guitar maestros, Brandon Ross. The piece is from Brandon's album, Puppet, which is available for purchase on iTunes. My conversation with Layla was pre-recorded earlier this week, so just sit back, listen, and enjoy. We're going to tell you a story. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sangoma. This is Batabile Mtombeni, your host, and I am so pleased to be here with my guest today, Layla Love. Hi, Layla.
Hi, it's delightful to be with you.
It's wonderful. I'm especially excited to have you on the show because we had a bit of serendipity happen back in March, you and I, that I thought was just astounding. You've published a book. What's the name of the book?
Stories Mediators Tell.
Yes, and of course, this show is Sangoma Stories from the Front Lines of Mediation.
Wow.
And we announced these new offerings to the world on the same day.
That's amazing.
Completely independently. So I've really been looking forward to talking with you about this. Tell me more about how you came up with this idea for this book and what it's all about.
Well, you may know that I've spent part of my career writing about mediation skills and writing law journal articles about mediation itself. Law journal articles, of course, have hundreds of footnotes, and they're kind of written in a stilted way. My husband claims that one is lucky if 20 people read a law journal article. But who knows? Anyway, this book, Stories, was part of a effort to reach out to people who would read things that people love to read. And people love to read stories. I believe people love to hear stories. So in an effort to make mediation accessible, my co-editor, Eric Galton, and I set out upon a project, a path to gather stories from prominent, successful mediators about the most exciting cases or events that had occurred to them. Now, the stories are fictionalized to the extent necessary to protect the identities of various parties, but they're wonderful stories.
Well, and that is something that I think a lot of mediators struggle with. It's a challenge because on the one hand, we want folks to know how mediation works and the wonderful things, share the wonderful things we experience in mediation, but one of the bedrock principles of mediation is confidentiality.
That's right.
So it can be a fine line to tread to do that. In telling the stories, how did you go about making sure that you protected the identities of the people involved?
everyone, all the writers did different things. Some people, and in one of the stories I wrote, I got permission of the parties to write the stories. Now, not everyone did that, and, you know, names are changed, dialogue is created, the geographical location has changed. I mean, enough has changed, so you just couldn't recognize the case or the parties for some people.
Well, still, I'm sure it makes really great reading. I know from my own experience as a mediator, you just can't make this stuff up.
You cannot make it up. You cannot create fiction as interesting as these stories.
Right, yeah.
In fact, I've come to believe all fiction is, you know, based on things that happened.
Of course.
And, you know, it's
yeah.
just slightly shifted to protect people.
Right. So. That's great. How did you decide which stories were going to be in the book?
We worked with people who we knew had been successful, so we believed people would want to hear from them. But the stories we got back immediately were just wonderful, you know, so it wasn't really a matter so much of picking. Some of the, I mean, because everything we got back was pretty good. Some of the stories needed a lot of editing. Now that's tough, you know, especially with busy people, it's tough because you have to go back and forth quite a bit. The American Bar Association, which is the publisher of this book, had a fabulous editor who was critical of the format of some of the stories. And we were upset about that because we thought, oh, no, another year, another 2 years to get this thing out. But he was this vigorous editor who imposed a kind of structure and order himself and jumped in, and he was fabulous.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's great to hear. Yeah. Do you have a favorite?
A favorite story?
Uh-huh. Or, you know, maybe it might be a couple, but I'm curious about what people can expect if they pick up the book, when they pick up the book.
I mean, I've told a few of the stories in the book, and they're favorites because they kind of stand for important principles to me. What I'd say to who's ever listening to this is that if you Google stories mediators tell, you'll get to the website of the American Bar Association publishing folks where they'll try to get you to buy the book. But they've posted a free story. And the first story, which is the free story that you can read, is maybe my favorite. I think it inspired the book. It's written by my co-editor, Eric Galton, called A Meeting of Strangers. And it's about the aftermath of a automobile accident or, you know, the one driver hits and goes through a red light and hits another person who gets killed.
Oh, dear.
And the family of the victim is just outraged, enraged, you know, cannot forgive this. The defendant driver is an elderly woman who became overwhelmingly depressed after this occurrence happened and, you know, kept wishing her own life had been taken instead of the elderly man whom she killed. Anyway, the story is the mediation of the action against her for, of course, a lot of money. And it's this amazing story of the two families kind of coming to understand each other. And the mediator, who was Eric Galton, talks about how the experience kind of transformed him, too, just in terms of the ability of people to come out of a tragedy and build something else, kind of move on. So, but he's you know, the dialogue is rich. It's a really fun story, and anybody listening can see for themselves right away. So I'm not going to ruin the story by
no spoilers.
Telling them here, since that one's so available.
Sure, sure. Yeah. It is amazing to me you're saying that this was a case that ordinarily would have gone to litigation. I guess it could have been, it was a civil case, was it?
It was a civil action, yes. headed for litigation. Of course, a lot of things do settle. And one of the remarkable things about this story, I don't think I'm giving anything away to say this, is that lawyers almost always, you know, tell their clients, just don't talk, you'll only make things worse, you certainly won't help anything, just, you know, because the defendant in this action really wanted to apologize and was never allowed to do that because of a concern that it might make the settlement figure
It'd
go
be an
higher.
Admission It'd be of some admission. Kind. Or,
that's right.
Right.
So, you know, that phenomena is totally common. And in this case, ultimately, the parties do have a direct conversation with each other, this life-changing conversation. So it's common, I think, for these sorts of cases to settle. What's uncommon is a mediated settlement where the parties actually get to see each other, talk to each other, put a face to what's been a kind of, to someone who's been a major player in their life.
Well, this is why I asked about that, because one of my great missions, you know, I have a passion for bringing mediation and the opportunities of mediation into common culture, into popular culture. And the idea that you can take a case that is a civil action like this and mediate it and allow human beings to get certain human needs met, the need to apologize, the need to hear an apology. I mean, how often when people are in litigation do you hear, I want them to say they're sorry. I want to hear them say they're sorry. And the lawyer has to say to them, well, in litigation, that's not something that you can necessarily get. You can get money. But money doesn't satisfy those things that people are often looking for in the way that mediation can.
That's right. That's right. Well, people need to read this story.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it changed me to read this story. And I think there's so many stories here. I'm eager to tell you more, but you might have a discussion agenda.
Well, no, that's fine, and we can come back to them. I do love to have a little bit of a teaser so that people will run out there and actually get the book for themselves and read about that, and I hope that it becomes a true influence in bringing people to understand mediation in a way that lets them know how it can work for them and for their loved ones and so forth. But the show is also about stories of mediators and your story, and so I'm eager to hear a bit about your story and how you came to be a mediator and be writing this or editing this book and so forth. So tell me a bit about how you grew up.
Okay. Well, as I grew up, I had really no interest in either law, and I didn't know what mediation was. I was wanting to be a writer,
you've accomplished that.
Wow, and this is really the favorite thing I've been involved in writing. Mm-hmm. So I grew up traveling a lot between Florida and North Carolina, where you might hear that accent coming in.
A little bit.
And you asked me about my high school before we went on the air. I went away to a boarding school in Connecticut, being from, you know, the southern part of the United States, and then went on to college in Massachusetts and kind of never went south again.
Mm-hmm.
But mediation got into my life when I ended up in law school. I had been a teacher, and realized that, you know, as a classroom teacher, this is probably just weak of me, I felt like I wasn't getting paid much, and I had so little influence. I didn't appreciate some aspects of the philosophy of the school where I was teaching, and I couldn't change that right away. And so people said, oh, you like to talk. You should go to law school.
I've heard that before.
Well, I went to law school, and it wasn't that interesting to me. I mean, I thought, oh, here's my chance to really think about philosophy of law. And when I went to college, it was the late 60s, early 70s, and it was super political, of course, as Vietnam War, and that activity was so kind of all-encompassing that I felt like I didn't have as much time for an education as I wanted. So I was hoping law school would
do that for you. I have a question about that then. There's some stereotypes about folks who come from the South, about their attitudes politically and so forth, and now you've come up east and attitudes might be a little bit different. I can imagine that this was a time of great introspection and thought and change for you on a personal level.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was always kind of in a minority as a Southerner. We mentioned Miss Porter School, which is where I went to high school.
I was dying, if you don't mind talking about that, we can talk about, you know, what metamorphosis you may have experienced. But I'm really curious about Miss Porter School.
So, well, Miss Porter School, when I went, was all girls. Mm-hmm. I think it may have accepted some men. No, I think it's still all women. Mm-hmm. It was considered a finishing school, but prided itself on being the most kind of intellectually stimulating or, you know, kind of advanced intellectually school. So it was concerned about placing people at the best schools. I loved horses back then. And Farmington, which is the nickname of the school, would allow for riding and that kind of thing. And actually, one of my greatest achievements was that I became the champion rider of Farmington, and my name was on a trophy.
Wow.
Along
with
hunting and jumping.
Okay, interesting.
So my name was on a trophy with Jacqueline Bouvier.
Wow.
<Isn't that awesome? laughs>
Oh, wow.
I don't know if I'll ever have an achievement like that, because to me, horses were such a big deal.
Yeah.
So
I have goosebumps.
So Farmington, the teachers there were awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, who ends up at a small town outside of Hartford, Connecticut, spending their life there? Well, they were really interesting, kind of eccentric, intellectual folk who were most inspiring. I mean, so
I think one of the reasons why I'm so curious about Miss Porter's is that I guess what I've learned in popular culture about what a finishing school is that it's more about, you know, etiquette and manners and things of that nature. That's the image that I get when I think about a finishing school. What is it really?
No, they, you know, the teachers were idea people. I mean, they were really top-notch thinkers. But there was some of what you're talking about. So your first year there, you could never go through a door until everybody around had gone through, because you had to hold the door for everybody else.
Interesting.
So they were kind of teaching manners in that way. So, you know, standing up when people came in a room, or that was part of it. But there were kind of a lot of among the student body, and I've said about the teachers already, you know, kind of eccentric, intellectual people who thought all this was nonsense.
Really?
So,
I have to say, I'm a little old-fashioned about that. You know, when I was growing up, we read the Bible in the King James. And so when we speak English at home, especially with English being, it's not exactly a second language, but my parents were very concerned that we speak English well. And they speak Zulu and Xhosa and Sotho and other languages, but they wanted us to speak English very well. So when a person says to me, "Who is it?" I say, "It is I."
Oh, that was nice.
Yes,
yeah.
That's how I was raised, and I get interesting reactions to that. But I'm very interested in ideas of decorum. It was really important in my home.
You would like Farmington.
I think so.
You would like it more than I like it.
I get the sense.
Oh, right. But I mean, you know, there are some wonderful memories from there. I was a little bit of a rebel, and I kept being that as I went to college. So, anyway.
Well, you did talk about being a little bit of a minority growing up in a Southern culture, and that when you hit college, it was the 60s and 70s. And so I'm also interested in what happened then. It sounds like having time for school was a bit of a challenge.
Well, it was, because my college was at Radcliffe, Harvard University, and you couldn't sit down for a meal in any of the lunch rooms at Harvard without being made to feel guilty that you were eating and others were not, and you should be out on the streets and you should be doing something or other. So after my first 2 years there, I never spent two consecutive semesters there. I worked in Tanzania and Africa one semester. I traveled in Mexico. In fact, my last semester in college, this is unbelievable to think of now. Here I am in a law school, which is pretty strict about how you get credit. So my last semester in college, I got full semester credit for hitchhiking around Mexico.
Right.
Yeah. I studied Spanish, mainly by talking with the people I was riding
with. What a way to do it, sure.
I studied sort of educational philosophy at the Center for Intercultural Documentation in Cuernavaca.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest project was I was toting around the books of E.M. Forster, and I read all his books in chronological order and wrote a paper about his life's work.
Wow.
And, you know, all that just kind of on my own and getting credit from different professors at Harvard. I mean, why did they let me do that? I mean, that was kind of crazy.
Because you were smart about that back then. What an education.
Isn't that
I
nice?
Mean, you can't do that in the classroom.
Yeah, no, you can't.
You know, the things that you learned about yourself, about life, about other people, I don't want to call it survival, because I don't think that it was necessarily a survival thing, was it?
It was at times.
Yeah,
I mean, just different people, you know, hitchhiking, that kind of thing. You had to get out of some
interesting
situations.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
I think I can admit this now, and I don't know whether my father will listen to this show or not, but I did do that once in South Africa, and my aunt was involved. She put me on the truck. Okay. I have to say that it wasn't my idea. If he's listening to this, he knows it wasn't my idea. But the thing is, I thought nothing of it. You know, I got to where I was going and so forth, and thought I would never hear of this person or this situation again. Well, about a month later, my dad came to visit me. I was in South Africa. I took a year off. I did a similar thing to what you did. I took a year off to do research and film a documentary in South Africa. And he came to see me, and we decided to go the same route that I had taken by truck coming. We went to see one of my grandfathers, who with whom I had been staying when I hitchhiked to come back to where I was actually living. So we stop at a rest stop to get some gas and pick up some snacks. And there was a gentleman in there and my dad, and they said some things in Zulu. And then my dad turns to me, he says, "This man says he knows you." I almost died. It was the truck driver.
Oh, my goodness.
I was like,
How wonderful.
I got out of it by saying he'd probably seen me on television. So, Dad, I'm sorry I didn't really tell the truth about that. But I had happened to go to the taping of a national television show, and I had made some remarks, and people around the country had called my family saying that they'd seen me. So it was a really plausible story.
Yeah, good story. Very good.
But I understand what you're talking about in terms of, you know, being in that situation, having to trust a complete stranger, being a woman traveling alone. You know, what was that like?
Well, I wasn't always alone.
Okay.
I sometimes had a female companion who would travel with me, sometimes a boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a... You know, most people are wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most people want to show you their country and are so proud of whatever you're looking at. And so I think my own kind of innocence and belief in people and curiosity went a very long way. Of course, if my daughter. No, I mean, you're so much younger than I am, and so I think you were much braver than I. It was more accepted in some senses.
I was 22. I think we were around the same age, no?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's a different era.
Time.
A different time.
Okay.
I think it's much more dangerous world now.
Yeah.
I think so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Your parents let you go.
Well, yeah, maybe. I'm not sure they, first of all, yeah, you know, Harvard University put its stamp on it, which is kind of crazy, you know, if you think about it. So in that sense, one could think, oh, well, this is a normal thing to do.
And you just let them think what they need to think.
Yeah, that's right.
That's really awesome.
And I could have stayed comfortably in Cuernavaca and not traveled around like I did.
Sure,
so,
sure. Oh, but that's an amazing way to enrich your life.
Yeah.
And you bring that back with you to the United States. You started out teaching, is it, after college?
After college, I was in the Teacher Corps, which is a program like Teach for America today, where you get a master's for teaching in an urban school and a rural school and developing programs for them.
And so, like you said, there were issues with what you were doing, philosophical questions that you had, and folks encouraged you to go to law school.
Yeah, and so I had this idea of law school. I was really going to get to think about things, and law school is not that way. I mean,
kind of discovered that. Well, this is your story. I have to say, though, that by the middle of second year, there comes that moment where you're like, well, you know, I'm in for the long haul because you finish what you start, but what am I doing?
Yeah, right. So I got out of law school and was so delighted to get back into education after a year or two. And then when I discovered mediation, I sort of felt at home again because my foray into law and the adversarial system, I mean, it was intriguing. It was fun in a way, but it just didn't seem like a great idea to me, the way that our legal system sets up the resolution of disputes.
Well, what was it about it in particular that just
didn't seem right?
Yeah.
I read something by Samuel Johnson once in which he said, you know, the basic idea is that you get two people to fight as unfairly as possible. Like you ask each side to say whatever they can to make themselves look good, the best things they can come up with to make themselves look good and the other side look bad. And, of course, you add to that mix really talented advocates who can make up, you know, who can spin.
We don't spin, we construe.
We construe. You build stories around whatever material you have.
Mm-hmm.
And then the theory is that a neutral in the middle makes a good judgment based on these two presentations by the different sides. And since one of the things I enjoyed in law school was trial advocacy, because you could tell stories and you could kind of act. And since I thought, well, you know, who wins this contest is going to be, at least in part, who's the good presenter. The lawyers are going to have a big influence on who wins a contest. I mean, that didn't quite seem like justice to me.
Well, of course, the idea of money comes in and who can afford to hire the best actor, you know, to do the work and so forth.
And just to counter that point, though, in fairness, I remember talking to an amazing lawyer named Larry Vogelman, who was part of the genesis of our Innocence Project here with Barry Sheck. Larry said to me once that in criminal law, anyway, you know, good lawyering counts for something, but 85% of it is the facts you're given. So that's the kind of counter, that that there is some bedrock of the situation that you can't kind of fight too much.
Right.
But I don't know.
Well, you know, there is the thing about thinking of law as perhaps a game of chess or, you know, any game that has substantially complicated rules. But if you know the rules and you know how to use the rules, then yes, it is more, it's less perhaps about the spinning stories and acting, and it is about following the rules. I mean, I think about some of John Grisham's work. I'm blanking on the name of the movie, but it's the one that stars Tom Cruise. I think it's The Firm.
The Firm.
Right.
That sounds right.
Yeah. And, you know, at the end of the book, when they talk, or the end of the movie at least, when he talks about his own safety and how he has set things up so that he's covered, he talks about how he used the law. He went back to what he learned in law school. You know, they made him study for the bar exam. He says they grilled him on the bar exam. And he went back and he used the law. And so there is that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
but still, it's this weird kind of contest that's set up, Samuel Johnson points out.
And I think that, you know, I was always in teaching sort of interested in the evolution of the law, you know, from back to when, you know, there was contests between knights and whoever won was right. You know, they won the contest over whatever was at stake. That's a fight of champions was one way that things got settled.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea there is that God would determine the outcome.
Precisely.
God would
bless
champion
or,
the champ, right. Champion, whichever champion had truth and right on their side. Or same deal with putting your hand in boiling water. If you were innocent, you were going to be protected. So in the adversarial system, I guess an appeal of it is that our society kind of blesses the whole structure of the courts and the judge, the jury, et cetera. The genesis is the public,
mm-hmm.
you know, endorsing
right.
the thing. What I love about mediation is that the outcomes, the truth that's determined in the end is left in the hands of the people whose dispute it is, who know the most, who have suffered, who can rebuild something afterwards. And so, somehow to me, that was the most exciting thing. When I turned to mediation, just intellectually as an exploratory thing, I ended up in a training program here in New York City with Josh Stolberg, who's a kind of training figure in this field, and Margaret Shaw, who's currently in New York at JAMS, were my first trainers. And every word they said, I was just enthralled. Every word, from the ideas behind mediation to the sort of how to begin, how to set it. You know, it just seemed fair, it seemed right, it seemed very appealing. And then when I started doing mediation, the fact that it worked
mm-hmm.
was just so
exciting.
What
sparked your initial interest?
It was just intellectual. The
mm-hmm.
Samuel Johnson
stuff.
Right, I was teaching philosophy of law at George Washington University in D.C. after law school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually an undergraduate course where there was a teaching component, and then I placed people into programs in D.C. And so I just got disenchanted with the idea. And so when I started looking at ADR, this was in about 1982, 83, it was just that it made sense as an idea. and I wanted to be part of it. I was so lucky because I hit it at the time that
it's really
ADR was
taking
off.
Right, yeah.
So,
yeah.
And I just to finish that thought, I had started a small business clinic at GW, which was quite successful. And so, and then my husband and I moved to New York. And so I had this background of doing clinical legal programs. And so when I intersected with mediation, it was kind of a natural to ask the law schools in this area, wouldn't you like to do a mediation clinic?
Right, yeah.
And so that's, that's what I did.
Right,
I'm the springboard of the Josh Stolberg, Margaret Shaw, and the, back then it was Victim Services,
mm-hmm.
now it's the New York Peace Institute.
Mm-hmm. With some permutations in between, it's interesting. It's
Safe Horizon
right,
was in between two bookends, yeah. And Safe Horizon was Victim Services was my partner in that first mediation clinic, and now the New York Peace Institute is still a partner in a mediation clinic I direct.
Well, one of the things you said then about mediation is that not only did it speak to these questions you were asking yourself, but that it worked.
Yeah.
What do you mean when you say it worked?
Well, in the sense that, you know, so frequently you have people coming into a mediation with no vision of how whatever it is that's dividing them between the, usually it's, or at least in many settings, it's one person across the table from them. Sometimes it's a family, sometimes it's a organization, but they have no vision of how it could be resolved. And they are very self-righteous about their own position and their own beliefs. And so what I mean by it works is that people get shifted in terms of not only what they're willing to do for the other person, but equally importantly, I think, how they see the situation themselves. So that ability, you know, we go to, by the word we, I mean people generally in society use therapists these days and can go years and years and years to a therapist to get a shift in their perspective. In mediation, you know, in 2 hours, in 3 hours, you can get this aha moment because you're sitting there with somebody who's hugely important in terms of what is probably a major conflict in your life. I mean, even if it's just a conflict between neighbors, for it to get to mediation, people have had to have experienced a lot of angst and sleepless nights and just upset over the matter. And so I think if they get shifted, it's wonderful because it has the ability, I think, to make one flexible in terms of how you see everything.
Yes. It is a moment, I guess it wouldn't be hyperbole for me to say, I live for those moments.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the reasons I look forward to mediation. One is the utter unpredictability of it. I mean, you really never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And people do amazing things
that
are totally unexpected. I have to say that I have the deepest respect for people who consent to participate in mediation and stick with it. It's not the easiest thing necessarily to start out with, but to experience that transformation and come to a point, and for me it usually happens around the quarter, the three-quarter mark.
Yeah.
You know, I think of mediations in terms of quarters.
Yeah. Wow.
And so it tends to happen around the three-quarter mark. And for them to experience that and to be a witness to it is such a beautiful thing. Yeah.
Can I tell one story from the book?
Do.
So I don't know why this one got sparked by this conversation, but it did. So here's the story. So the writer of this story is Ben Cunningham, who's a Texas mediator who does a one. He's terrifically humorous. So it's a very funny story. But he describes a situation in which two business partners who have or basically gone to their lawyers because of wanting a divorce over the business, but they're each claiming $10,000 because of what wrongs were done them, and they're both totally adamant that they are owed $10,000 and they won't settle for a dime less, and they don't care how much litigation costs. The thing is stuck as it can be. They're angry with each other. So the mediator keeps trying to use different metaphors, draw different analogies, and he starts talking about when, you know, ships cross out in space and this and that. And apparently, the parties are buying none of this. They said the mediator's crazy, but they keep saying things about golf, you know, and hitting golf balls. And finally, the mediator kind of gets that they're both golfers. And at some point kind of randomly says, you know, maybe you all should settle this on the golf course. Well, that idea takes hold.
Oh, my.
And then, so both parties get super excited, both of the men, about let's have a golf match. Winner gets $10,000.
Wow.
And,
okay.
And, you know, here are people who had built a business together, who had clearly a lot of things in common and a lot of good energy at one point or another. So the mediation proceeds to set up the rules of the golf mat and how the payoff is going to... Well, apparently, you know, the golf match happened.
Uh-huh. Was the mediator there?
No. The parties, you know, had in their whole lives together, had had many golf matches. They didn't need a mediator to,
okay.
And you know, they were these competitive guys,
right.
You know, who,
I just would want to see this.
So, So during the course of this golf game, they got so excited about some new idea they had for a business, they never even finished the golf game and went on to construct some
that
new project.
That is amazing.
Together. But it, you know, one can just feel how that could happen.
Of course.
How that energy of kind of the friction, whatever their underlying claims for $10,000 was about, could so, it would just be so much fun to go out on the golf course and fight over $10,000 instead of handing your lawyer $20,000 or $30,000 to fight over $10,000.
You know, when you said that they didn't care how much the litigation was, mm-hmm. That's when you understand that it isn't about the money,
yeah.
And it isn't really about anything particularly rational.
Yeah.
It is about emotions. It is about things that perhaps they're not acknowledging to themselves, and certainly not acknowledging to each other, that it's not about the money.
That's right. So, I mean, well, often there are important principles at stake,
mm-hmm.
People wanting to be appreciated mm-hmm. for their particular contribution and the business situations. Often there's an idea person and a worker person who's made the whole thing possible, and people don't feel appreciated for their contribution. So.
Right. Well, you talked about acknowledgement and appreciation and, you know, giving due credit for contribution. There's also another thing that can happen in mediation where perhaps people who haven't really developed a relationship with each other and haven't worked together, but perhaps have an opportunity for an ongoing relationship, you know, who knows. But when you find that they have something in common, they have a common connection. You know, I mediate at the CCRB, and there was a case that I remember in particular that involved a parent who had left a child in a car and run into the store. So the parent was double parked and left the child and ran in to the store to pick up a few vegetables for dinner. And the police officers came by and noticed because there was a woman who was concerned about this child in the car. And so a summons was issued and all sorts of things, and it ended up in mediation. And what I was able to discover through the conversation is that the police officers themselves were parents. And when this came out, now they were talking to each other as parents. who all understood what it's like to be under that kind of pressure where you just need to get home and make dinner,
right?
You know, and you think that the child's going to be okay for just a moment. I'm just dishing for just a second. I want to, you know, and so it created an atmosphere of empathy. It allowed them opportunities to share ideas about managing. You know, the parent was a single parent and it was a young child, and so mediation allowed for that, where if it had just gone to court, he may have had to just pay a fine, and the hurt feelings between himself and the annoyance of the police officers would have continued into perpetuity.
Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, those kind of situations, you can get criminal.
Precisely. Exactly.
I mean, you know, you can ultimately have your kids
taken
away.
You. Yeah.
I mean, which is just kind of unthinkable.
Right.
In some of these. I actually had that situation with a friend who was coming to a daycare place, bringing her child to a daycare place and leaving the baby at home nearby. And all the other parents at the daycare center knew this and were talking about her behind her back.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a friend of mine, and I finally thought, I've got to do something here. And so I told her that, you know, it was kind of seen as dangerous what she was doing and probably unacceptable. And of course she was furious that I brought it up. But I think it had an impact too. So I don't know.
Yes, it can lead to really you know, unfortunate and sort of draconian results, you know, whereas there might be opportunities for understanding. This particular
right.
parent got to understand that the police were really concerned for
his
child.
Well, and it's not, from a society point of view, it's not allowed.
Exactly, right.
I mean, you just can't do that.
Right, yeah. Yes, and so perhaps having an understanding of that is another benefit. Where it's not just about rote punishment, but about an opportunity to come to an understanding about things. Wow. So you have been in mediation for quite a while now. It's managed to hold your attention for this long.
It has. That's true. That's a good point.
Yeah.
I worry about that a little bit.
Really?
I think. I look around at my friends, and I think so many people keep sort of shifting what they do. And, of course, I admire that, too. And I think I stayed at the same thing for a long time. And I sort of feel like, you know, the one trick kind of.
Oh, no. But it's a really good trick. No, not at all. I mean, I think what it says is just how deep and rich mediation is.
I think it does. I mean, what's so exciting about being in a law school is, and I suppose this is true of any graduate school, there's this whole new group of people every year who are so amazing. I mean, it's just such a blessing to have this position, which gives you this sort of inside track with a group of people you get quite close to. I have 16 students each year that I pick out of a very large applicant pool, usually somewhere between 75 to 100 applicants for the spots in our mediation clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really get to know them. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of fun. And then, you know, I work in other programs where I get to know students. So
I'm curious about what you look for that says these 16 are the ones who are going to come into the program.
So that's a good question. So you obviously you want a group that's diverse in a lot of ways. You know, that. So I like some people say they love litigation, and that doesn't get them booted out. Litigators are fine.
Mm-hmm.
I think I look for some sort of spark, just people being alive, being curious, being energetic, having. It worries me if resumes don't show some sort of variety of experience.
Hmm.
You know, if people have kind of done
The same path.
Mm-hmm. What it in my worry would take the form of sort of challenging someone in an interview. You know, why haven't you branched out a little bit? Why haven't you done some things outside of whatever your group is, whether if they're in a certain part of the city or a certain ethnic group? You know, if they haven't reached out a little bit, mm-hmm. it worries me.
I can imagine that an advantage of having branched out is learning that kind of flexibility that is really helpful to have as a mediator. And so I'm curious about how you might describe the kinds of personality traits that contribute to somebody being a good mediator.
Well, there's certainly no cookie cutter, mm-hmm. you know, and I think it's quite scary for young people to go through a training program and look at the trainer and say, I'm not like that person, you know, and the message should not be, you have to be like that person, you know, obviously, you've got to be yourself. So I guess I just go back to energy, sort of a smile, a sense of, and yet, what you were talking about earlier, that you had in your family this great respect for using language properly, and, you know, so people with this sort of sense of order and respectfulness and appreciation of tradition, I mean, those are wonderful traits, too.
Mm-hmm.
Although you get kind of some wild card kids, you know, who are a little bit ungoverned or unbridled, who will kind of say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sometimes they're a positive influence, particularly if paired with
somebody who's it's an interesting thing because as you're describing this, I'm thinking about what happens in mediation. One of the things that I remember learning as I was training in mediation is that whole concept of the elephant in the room. And we all learn about the elephant in the room. And one of the roles of the mediator is to address the elephant in the room. Well, a person who's really wedded to decorum, I mean, that's all about avoiding the elephant.
Right.
We're not going to come near that elephant. So, you know, the flexibility of a mediator is understanding that in role, it's important to address the elephant and allow people, because that's the crux of the thing often.
Right.
It's the stuff that people are dancing around
is
the crux of the thing. But being able to do it in a way that respects and nurtures dignity and respectfulness and so forth.
And I believe people really want to talk about those things that are so close to their heart and have preoccupied them sometimes for a decade, so that it needs to see the light of conversation, whatever it is that's troubling.
Right.
I was thinking for those who are listening to this, rather than seeing it, we're sitting here looking at the book Stories Mediators Tell.
Yes.
And so there's this wonderful story by Margaret Shaw, whom I've mentioned, who's a mediator with JAMS, in which she talks about a very serious, somber mediation at a law firm, very formal, and conference table, and portraits of elderly people on the wall, and nothing much exciting happened. And at one point in the mediation, somebody said something that had some promise in it, and Margaret pushed away from the table, and the chairs were on rollers. And that movement caused her to fall or be thrust under the table. And so it was a glass top table. And you know, Margaret is so wonderful, and I think she laughed like you're laughing now, you know. Whereas one can easily imagine feeling, particularly if you're wedded to decorum, that you were taught, you know, really
mortified,
upset, mortified, defensive, et cetera. But she laughed. And so that shared moment of kind of absurdity, and, you know, because somebody commented, Margaret was there 1 minute, and then she was gone. where did you go? change things.
Yeah.
It changed the whole atmosphere, and not in any earth-shaking way, but the situation ultimately settled, which had seemed
impossible.
And you imagine, well, what was that? You know, that this momentary, you know, fleeting accident can cause everything to change. Well, it brought people together. They had a shared experience that was kind of fun. And, I mean, fun because Margaret had the grace and dignity to go right on.
Well, it requires a certain sort of, you know, self-confidence
You need confidence. You need not to be I guess this goes back to your question about mediator traits. I mean, we can all get defensive, but to the extent you can, as a mediator, you don't want to take offense. You want to allow things to kind of flow and not get stuck with you getting upset about what's happening.
Right.
I always tell mediators to stay happy.
Yeah.
In other words, when people are getting really unhappy around them, not to get unhappy themselves.
Right.
Because it just doesn't help anything if they suddenly take the whole weight of the dispute upon themselves.
Well, it's a really important thing that I've been taught and learned in practice is that mediators must, what works for me is to remember that it's not my thing.
Right.
I don't own it. And to not try to take it away from the parties, but respect who owns the issue.
That's right. That's right. And yet, at the same time, I think it matters that you kind of care deeply about it.
Yeah.
So balancing those two things, caring deeply and not caring. Actually, that reminds me of T.S. Eliot in one of his poems. Ends it. I'm not going to guess which one right now, but he teaches to care and not to care.
Teaches
to stand still.
Right.
And some, there's something about that weighing against each other, a deep caring and a willingness to let it go.
Well, yes, and having no stake in the outcome,
right.
You know, it's, I guess, one way of describing what that means, but being totally invested in a process that really allows the parties to fully exercise their autonomy and be, at the same time be able to hear the other side and be heard as well. That's what the process is really about.
Right.
Yeah. We are, it's amazing how time has flown. I've so enjoyed talking with you. We have a few moments left. I want to talk about the idea of success. Often I'm asked, you know, when is a mediation successful? And I'm curious about how other mediators handle the idea of success or the idea of mediation failing. Is there such a concept as mediation failing?
Well, you know, so many of us in mediation get happy if the mediation results in agreement and an end to the situation. And, of course, teaching mediation, you say, no, 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 agreement is not the measure of success. You know, these small shifts that people have are just as important, and you can do a terrible job if there's an agreement and a good job and there's no agreement. I'm trying to think. Oh, Florence Nightingale was once said that hospitals should do the sick no harm. And so one measure of I guess this isn't, but there's got to be on the a low bar is doing no harm to people in conflict. On the high bar, it seems to me there's this potential for completely transforming a situation, you know, and allowing people to kind of free up from a conflict that's been oppressing them for a very long time. And whether that's just having a slightly different perspective on it or having a complete resolution that's captured in a written agreement, either of those things are success. in my book. And sometimes as a mediator, you don't know. You
it's
have
true.
No idea.
It's true.
You know, you've really changed things. Not you, but the parties by your kind of orchestrating a situation. And they don't show it. There's this face-saving reality, so people can't always say how much or whether they've been moved. So success is tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's a very quick story. I once was asked to mediate a dispute between a parent and their child when years before I had mediated a probate kind of situation between three siblings. And so now it was the mother who had been in this first mediation and her daughter. And at some point she told me in the second mediation, you don't see people again, by and large. So you would never hear this story.
Highly
this was
unusual.
A really,
yeah.
So she tells me, I just have to tell you this, that the agreement that was drafted between her and her siblings at the end of the first mediation, she said, I kept that I've had that agreement in my top bureau drawer ever since the day we concluded that mediation. And every morning it gives me the power to keep going. And, of course, it had nothing to do with me. It meant she had a family. It meant there was a connection between her and her siblings that had worked out. But who would think?
It's still an amazing validation of at least the process.
That's right.
And it's a joyful thing to understand that you've been so intimately involved in helping her to achieve that. It's awesome.
It's in somebody's top dresser.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing.
And that's how important it is to her.
Yeah. I sometimes tell that. I've said it a couple of times in training programs to say, you know, the written word survives.
Sure,
be careful what you do in writing, because it has a life. So that was success, but who knew? I had no idea.
Sure.
Except for this, you know, happenstance of her telling me years later.
Oh, this is so awesome, and I'm actually feeling a bit of regretful that our time has come to an end, but I'm really grateful for this time to have spent with you, and I have to tell you, it sort of renewed my passion for what we do, and we do an amazing work. We're in an amazing field, aren't we?
Yes, and the other thing that's exciting to me is to be a partner with you in this Stories Mediators. That's the name of your series or something close
to it. Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation.
Wow,
yes,
what a coincidence.
It was a beautiful thing, and I'm hopeful that it permeates, you know, throughout the field and into larger society. For those who are listening, I really thank you for tuning in and having the curiosity to find out a little bit more about what mediation is and perhaps exploring further to find resources in your own area that can help you to access mediation and find out what it can do for you in your own disputes. But this is really awesome. Tell me one more time how folks can find out about the book.
I think the easiest way is to this is the way I do it every time. Google Stories Mediators Tell. I suppose if you added my name, which is Leela Love, but you don't really need that. It's ABA, American Bar Association Publishing, is the publisher of the book. And as I mentioned early on in the interview, they do put up one free chapter,
mm-hmm.
which is...
Mm-hmm.
fun to read, I'm told.
Right. Well, I have the sense that this might be a chicken soup kind of reading for folks. There's so much in there about transformation, and I know that folks can be transformed just by reading about it as well. So I hope that folks pick up the book and enjoy it and bring mediation into their own lives. So thank you so much, Leela.
Thank you for
talking with you.
I feel the same way. Thank you.
All righty.